Hi, and welcome to the Rare Business Podcast. My name is Adrian Swinsko, and I'm a consultant, advisor, researcher, and writer on all things related to customer service and customer experience. Through this podcast, I seek out and interview CEOs, entrepreneurs, business and tech leaders, and leading thinkers about what it takes to build organizations that produce better outcomes for both customers and employees in this fast-moving modern age that we live in. If this is your first time listening to one of these interviews, then welcome. And please do dive into the archives at adrianswinsko.com, as I've now completed over 250 of these interviews in the last few years. If this is not your first time listening, then thank you for returning, and I'll aim to do a good enough job to keep you coming back week after week. Anyway, that's enough from me right now. Let's get into the interview. So today I'm speaking to Rob Walker, who is the VP of Decisioning and Analytics at Pega. And Rob, for listeners of our podcast who've been here with us a while, I've spoken to Rob before. He's a good guy, and we have really interesting conversations. But Rob, for the benefit of people that haven't heard our conversations before, can you tell us a bit about you and a bit about the work that you do for Pega?
Sure, yes. The background to sort of my interest in AI and all of these kind of things is that I did a PhD in AI in the 90s, so this was really some serious like before the real hype all started, but it was really, you know, out of you know, scientific curiosity about AI. I didn't know it would be that big. Mm-hmm. But then co-founded a company that really made that operational, and that company was acquired indirectly by Pega. And at Pega, I'm responsible for our AI and mm-hmm. decisioning space, which mm-hmm. is not exactly the same thing, but it's very mm-hmm. related to each other.
Perfect. So we were talking sort of before on a panel that I was helping moderate here at PegaWorld, and as part of that, and in the lead up to that, we were talking about this idea around one-to-one marketing, personalization, and then you introduced this idea, this new, almost, it felt like an extension, where rather than personalization, you actually talked about relevance, customer relevance, and I thought, that's interesting, that's new. What do you mean by that, and how is that different from sort of personalization?
Okay. Yeah, so relevance is really about, is customer going to say yes to this, right? Is it like, is this in the right channel, in the right moment, and have we identified the needs of that customer accurately enough, right? Okay. So that's relevance.
Right.
And we use AI to do that, mm-hmm. right? Then after that, in that particular channel, whether that's a website or a mobile device or whatever it is, then we're trying to create sort of the, you know, make it personal. Mm-hmm. By saying, okay, if this is what we want to talk about, mm-hmm. how should we do that? How should we talk about? What's the language?
Right.
What's the image we're going to use? What's the format? What's the voice, if this was a voice channel?
Okay.
Right. Those are things that would personalize this.
Right. Right?
It's,
okay.
It's not something like, dear Mrs. So-and-so. It's a lot more involved right now.
So in actual fact, it's not that relevance comes after personalization, is actually relevance comes before, because it's an enabler of personalization.
Yes, yes. Personalization is really trying to sort of, you know, boost the relevance by making it that decision, that relevant decision, appeal to you.
Mm-hmm. And how are you seeing people use AI? How are you promoting people using kind of AI to sort of help with that, to increase the relevance and then to help with kind of the personalization?
Yes, so I think in almost all cases, Pega is responsible for that first part. It's like deciding on, this is what we should be talking about, mm-hmm. right? Across, because we've been learning about that through all the different channels, all the different moments that are there. And then it's really a matter of, like, you know, the particular situation where we're in, whether we also take care of the personalization, mm-hmm. or maybe that in the channel, mm-hmm. they have something that would do that for them, right? And would say, okay, well, if this is what you want to bring under the, you know, to the attention of this particular customer,
yeah.
this is the image you should use, this is the size it should be, and it should be like the top half of the screen.
Right.
You know, sometimes we do that, uh-huh. sometimes other companies do that.
Okay.
We focus on the relevance part.
Okay. But that will change over time. Obviously, customers kind of change, right? And therefore, the relevance and the personalization needs will kind of change.
Yes.
And how does is that the
the like the control over time or the tweaking over time, is that done by the system as well, or is it done by human intervention, or how does that work?
No, that's typically done. Humans can always play a role in these kind of things, but generally now that is also done by AI and decisioning, right? So it will learn what kind of, well, relevance is particularly simple, right? It's like the AI is deciding this is the next best action. If that's not the right action,
sure. It
will learn from that and try to improve itself, and generally will improve itself very quickly. And the same is true for the personalization, right? So you can try out a lot of different variations. So once the decision is made, like this is what we're going to talk about, you can have 20 variation in language and image selection and just see what works,
right?
And
so there is a lot of test and learn.
It's a complete test and learn to figure out what works in what combination, what language to generate. Okay. There's a lot of thing going on there.
So, I mean, the other thing that we talked about previously, which I find really interesting, was you've developed and really baked into your system the T-switch, which toggles between, you know, opaque and, you know, transparent AI kind of models. And what struck me, I mean, because we talked about that sort of about a year ago, if not kind of more than that, and it struck me that it's such an important thing, particularly in this era of GDPR and compliance and data breaches and all these different sort of things, and mistakes and stuff. And then I was thinking, this feels like a really big thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it struck me as I had this question, I was like, why are people talking about this and doing this? And is it missing from the conversation and the actions of people, or am I missing something? I mean, is it, you know, are other people doing it, or are you just kind of ahead of the curve on that type of stuff?
Yeah, can it be both though? So you're missing a little bit, and the
okay.
I think what's happening,
I'm happy to be wrong. Yeah. I'm here to learn as well.
The situation is twofold. So first of all, to your point, first of all, it should be a much bigger thing, and I think people are, especially in Europe, actually a little bit naive about what GDPR really means. Everybody now seems to think that AI, that's GDPR, is only about, you know, opt-in and opt-out, and it is about, you know, the right to be forgotten and the right to query what data a company has on you.
Yeah.
That's part of it. The other part, or another big part of it, is like that any automated decision needs to be explained.
Right.
Right? And that means, and that's, to your point, not that many people talk about it, but it's part of GDPR.
Yes.
Right? So the first lawsuits, I think, will be very clear.
Okay.
That when customers demand and say, so why didn't I get this mortgage, or why did you ask me this question and you can't explain it, right? The answer cannot be, oh, well, the system, you know, did this.
Sure.
So GDPR mandates that. So I think part of the answer is a lot of companies will wake up to what is actually in GDPR,
right,
and then get it right.
Okay.
The other part is that a lot of companies are ahead of GDPR in their practices.
Okay.
Not just because they're good companies, but also because it's an operational risk.
Yes.
Right. So they have like an internal sort of, you know, model compliance office, right, that would look at particular models that are developed, see if it has a bias, see if it's, you know, developed through the corporate standards and things like that before it's approved, right?
But then if you're dealing with a big organization that's kind of dealing with millions of customers and kind of tens of millions of, you know, interactions and things, I mean, how do you do that in a robust way? I mean, is it just going to be sampling that they're going to be able to do that to try and make sure that they're on the right kind of track? Because otherwise that seems like a huge effort. It's frightening if you think about it.
Yes. No, it is a serious effort. I mean, these things are going through, you know, tests, sets that are, so it's like a relatively well understood process, but it only works if you have relatively small number of models,
right?
And I think where we're now going, especially to determine relevance, right? I mean, in our case, we would routinely execute like 1,000 predictive models to calculate one single next best action,
right?
Right, and then if you say yes or no or maybe or whatever your response to that action is, we would take that into account and recalculate it.
Okay,
right. So 1,000 models through that model office, that's just not going to fly.
Sure.
Right? And that's part of obviously why we introduced, you know, the T-switch to operationalize that and basically set like a policy, an AI policy in place, right? And because in our case, all of the AI, as far as it's in the customer engagement area, is fueled through, or is being executed, I should say, through a centralized engine, mm-hmm. you have, you know, a chokehold yes. on the AI, and therefore the switch can really say, okay, in these particular areas of the business, we allow opacity. Here, we insist on transparency.
Yeah.
And it's a single place where you can do that.
So there's two questions I have on that. So I want to come back to the policy bit, because that's a big area. But the thing that intrigued me is that last time we talked about opaque and transparent systems, and you talked about how transparent systems because they have to have this inherent ability to explain themselves, to be auditable and things, and opaque ones don't. Mm-hmm. But these ones, the opaque ones, have way more horsepower, as it were, than the transparent ones. Now, the thing that intrigued me was, like, what's the difference in terms of the quantum difference, in terms of the power, as it mm-hmm. were? And I was wondering if you could give us sort of an example, so explain, so we can get a sense of the difference in power of these kind of like systems, but like explain to the difference between two different laptops, as it were.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean.
I understand what you mean. I think and there is obviously, you know, there is a spectrum there. It also depends on what do you call explanation.
Sure.
Right. Because the thing is with these opaque algorithms and the models they produce, the models are just very clever, but also very complicated. They look at a lot of different things, and all of these things are correlated in special ways, and they understand that pattern. Mm-hmm. To understand that pattern and make it understood by a human, mm-hmm. you need to explain so many things that it would take a week
sure.
to spell it out to you,
sure.
right? And also a human would never be able to get that, you know, in her head. It's like you have like, okay, these 10,000 things, if they, anyway, so that will be very complicated. So that's what opaque means, right? It
yeah.
doesn't mean that it's completely inexplicable always. It
no.
just means it's just not practical to actually explain it exactly.
Right.
So I think that's the difference. In terms of performance, if you take it a little bit to an extreme, really transparent models are very simple models, mm-hmm. right? Humans can really only factor in, I don't know, 5-7 different things.
So like if A and B, then C, sort of.
Maybe, yes. Right. And then it gets already. And then if C is actually like, you know, it's a difficult thing, right? For instance, one trivial example is like, if you're trying to predict who's going to buy like baby toys, mm-hmm. right? And then you look at like age of people, then obviously you would expect, you know, parents to buy these kind of things. So that's an easy trigger.
Yeah.
But then there's a long period that it doesn't happen. And then when they are grandparents, they will buy it again.
Mm-hmm.
That already for humans, those kind of non-linear kind
sure.
of behaviors. Now that's just age.
Yeah.
Right now have 1,000 of those that also correlate, and it becomes really, really impractical.
Right.
So the difference, if you insist on an algorithm that is simple enough for a human to say, or to explain to a customer, okay, this is why we rejected you for a mortgage,
yeah.
right? It needs to be pretty simple.
Uh-huh.
And that means it will not be very good.
Yeah, okay.
In the scheme of things.
Right.
Yep. That said, the benchmark to this is often a human judgment, right? So if we rewind, you know, 50 years or whatever, before we did any automation in that area, you would ask a human, why was I, you know, rejected?
Mm-hmm.
And the human would either be like, you know, a whole ledger of things if they were very complicated, or it would be a lot of intuition and gut feeling that the humans also wouldn't be able to explain.
Sure.
And they would just make up something.
Yeah, well, we have our own sort of opaque systems.
Completely.
Inside our heads. So let's go back to the policy idea. I mean, and we talked about this—the idea, you know, policy, whether it's kind of governance or risk management, quality assurance, all that type of stuff. And it feels to me like there's—I think I was explaining before—it's like a bit like a cart and a horse sort of situation. Now, we're not saying what is the cart and what is the horse, but sometimes it feels like some people start with the tech and then think about the policy and all the infrastructure that goes around
yes.
that.
Yeah.
But I also think I have a feeling that it almost should be the other way around. And is that your sense? Is almost like figure out what you want to do and then figure out the right sort of kits to do that? Or can you parallel track these things?
Yeah, well, I think in the real... So I agree, obviously. That
right.
First of all, that would be completely ideal.
Yeah.
I think in reality, regulations and policymakers sort of also need to see what is possible.
Well, sure.
Right? So in that sense, it always comes later.
Yeah.
I mean, we put the T-switch in also, you know, after we actually had algorithms that would be opaque and we didn't have that control, right? And it would then probably be back to that model office that I spoke about. So now we automate that. But I think in that sense, it will always come a little later.
So retrospectively, I mean, I guess that it's interesting when you think about GDPR. GDPR is probably one of the only pieces of legislation that's been written in recent times that's potentially future-proof and proactive, and that it sees what's coming, and then it's almost is designed for the future, whereas most legislation is reactive because they see a problem come up and then they legislate against it, I guess.
Sure, but I would, even with GDPR, I would agree that it is reactive, right? It's looking at like some of these,
bad practices and
best
things.
Practices, and it's like, okay, we need to control that. Let's put that that thing in place. But that said, it is pretty forward-looking. And also about that the GDPR clause that I mentioned before about having to explain any automated decision that has any legal significance.
Yeah.
You know, you can see all the legalese crop in, right? So this is why the lawsuits will be interesting, to see what is a significant decision, and did we automate it? And then you have the obligation to explain it.
So what do you actually think is going to happen with the GDPR and the interface with technology and personalization and things? And is it going to be it's going to be in this iterative sort of environment that mistakes will be made, and then examples will be made of those kind of people that have made the mistakes, and then the things will adjust? Or how do you think it's going to play out? Because it feels like it's like a lot of this big, thick legislation, really complicated, with really, really heavy fines associated with it. But what's not clear is how it's going to be enforced or monitored or managed, unless there's this public breach, as it were.
Yes.
So I it feels like there's a sandwich without any filling. So it's two bits of bread.
Yeah, and honestly, I don't know exactly, but it is true that it's not easily enforceable.
Right.
In its entirety. But I do think that it will have an effect.
Yeah.
It's already having an effect of companies having to sort of look neutrally at, like, do we really need that data? And also, we get this data from really kind of a weird source around people that figure out what you did on your device when you were traveling, and it's like, you know, should we really be using that kind of data? So I think that's a good thing. But there are also effects that we don't even know how they will play out, right? For instance, you have like lots of like fintech companies, for instance, that can just say, hey, you can go to your bank and you can have a complete data dump, and we can start
a
PSD2
sort of like type of an open banking sort of initiative.
Exactly, right? So we will see how that will play out. But I think it will definitely has an effect, certainly on the public, but also all the companies that I talk to, of like, okay, let's look at this carefully on how do we need all the data, because it can be expensive.
Okay. And so, you know, we're coming to the end of PegaWorld, and there's been lots of talk about, you know, technology and digital transformation and agile and AI and robotics and all of these different things. And we've heard some, you know, amazing and really interesting stories and stuff. And so if somebody was listening to this and thinking about, well, I want to improve my personalization, I want to increase the engagement with customers, and, you know, given the next best thing, or the next best action, or the next best conversation, to try to bring me closer, make me better, as it were. This is all like, it feels like a maelstrom of stuff going on. I mean, what would you say to people that are either in this, or they're thinking about stepping into it and taking on? What would be the best piece of advice you give to them in terms of to put them on the right track? So like, think about doing this, or these two or three things you think these are things you need to pay attention to.
Yeah, well. So first of all, don't start, because we've been hearing a lot about, okay, well, we put this massive brain in this enterprise brain, and that's, I mean, that's ambitious. I mean, that's where everybody is going, and a lot of our clients are there, but they didn't start there, right? They started with like probably following the money, right? In the sense like, okay, where can we have, what's a business outcome where we can have, you know, if we improved it even by a little bit, right? How that would make a lot of difference, and how could we prove that?
Sure.
Right? We're really very much focused on starting this with business outcomes and not using AI or anything.
Sure.
For AI's sake.
Yeah.
Right. So that's an important thing. Right. So it's like, okay, where can I make a lot of money? Like, for instance, the stuff we did for Sprint here in the US was right around, you know, churn and retention. Right. That was a pressing problem. That's where we stepped in, and then we have the AI to try and figure out how to better retain customers. So that's a good start.
Yeah.
And then you can do it in multiple channels and eventually omni-channel, and you can use it for different purposes.
Figure out a problem or a pain point, figure out how you can use the technology and the techniques to try and address that or make that kind of better and produce better outcomes, and then that familiarizes yourself with that, that, you know, the approach, and then you can think about scaling from there.
That's correct. And if I can add one more thing to
of
it,
course.
Like just from a practical perspective, because people even in those circumstances, like the companies we work with are so big that even that could be a risk.
Right.
So then I think best practice, what we're seeing is that they would take a percentage of their consumers,
right?
Feeding it to this brain, to this AI, right? To make decisions, see if it works, see if there are weird biases, see if it works operationally, look at customer satisfaction, and then they just dial it up to 5%, 20%, 100%, right? But even there, so it's not like you're jumping off an edge with AI. It's like, okay, let's bring it in. Now, you start with a particular KPI, you start with just a few channels, and you start with a sample of your customer base.
Okay, and then so within this Pega world, the big announcement was around Infinity, which is the now sort of soup to nuts, all integrated back end and front end sort of suite, which is all kind of interconnected and things. I mean, that's a huge initiative, and I think it's going to be incredibly successful. I mean, but for you and your space in terms of decisioning and analytics and stuff, mm-hmm. What's next on the horizon for you guys? Is it just kind of improving kind of what you've got, just kind of learning and just kind of refining, or is there, what's the next big thing that you're going to tackle?
Yes, so there's a couple of things. So first of all, it's not in terms of Infinity, I just want to add, it's not just about just being interconnected, it's also about really being unified, right?
Yeah.
So which means that, you know, technically it means it's all one code base and things like that, but in practice,
sorry,
that
I
really
apologize for my simplified language.
Well, but
it was off script.
Okay, so but for if we're just talking about AI and looking at, like, we are definitely and I personally am a lot more ambitious than just, you know, calibrating it and get it better. So there are a few things that I think are very important. So first of all is the scale of the thing. I think we're running at an incredible scale already with our customers, but there will be even more demand, mm-hmm. right? There will be even more channels, some of the channels we don't even know about, and that means that also the performance of all this AI, how fast can it learn, how fast can it execute, all of these things become important. And that sounds like, okay, well, that's like maybe a little bit of a boring dimension, but it's technically not trivial to do.
Sure.
But secondly, we're sort of currently using AI as the foundation for human decisions, and you know, we're so that's why we make a difference between AI and decisioning, which is not even a word, but decision management, right? So we have AI getting you all of these insights, thousands of insights. Who's going to buy this? Who's going to try it? Who's going to not pay the bills? Who's going to respond well to this collections message? All of these things, thousands of things, and then we have rules on top of it that say, okay, well, if that's the case, what's more important? How much budget do I have for this? So it's this combination of different things. Where I think AI will go and will go rapidly is go into that level as well.
Right.
So really it's going to not just write its own code, right, but write its own business strategy.
So like an operating system for the kind of almost, let's say, this is what how you should be organized.
Yes,
right.
Exactly. And okay. And that's a step change, right? Because that means that it's not just you have AI that is sort of, you know, doing its magic and having all of these insights. It's actually AI that says this is a better business strategy for your company. Do you choose to accept it or not?
I think we should leave it there. Thanks very much, Rob.
Thank you. Yeah.
Well, that's it for another interview. I really hope you enjoyed it. Now, every time I complete one of these interviews, I learn something new, and I try and incorporate that new learning into my writing, my speaking, my workshops, and the consulting that I do for my clients. If you're interested, you can find out more about how I work with clients over at adrianswinsko.com. But one final thing before I go, please consider heading over to iTunes or whichever podcast platform you choose to use, and do leave a review. Every little helps, as they say. Anyway, that's all for now. Thank you for listening, and do listen in again. All the very best.